Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, it's Healthy Gut Girl. This is Stuff Your Doctor Should Know, and I am coming to you live from deep inside your large intestine. And I am excited once again because I have such a great guest today. And I just decided that I think podcasts are just like the new schooling. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you don't need, like, I feel like you can get so much more knowledge and such a solid education by listening, by binging certain podcasts. I feel like I take these webinars online and stuff, and I won't say through who or anything like that, but just like conventional, you know, watch this webinar on hormones or watch this webinar on gut health or whatever. And, you know, some of them you have to pay for. And, you know, it's just, I get very little compared to listening to some podcasts that are available right now for you to listen to, like Georgie Dinkoff and Danny Roddy's GE podcast, Generative Energy podcast. And then I was turned on to this guy, Jay Feldman, who is with us today, and his podcast, the Energy Balance podcast. Like, I'll binge his show and literally sit there with a pen and paper and just, I feel like I'm in class. Like, it's awesome. And I'm so grateful for it. You know, you just can learn so much and apply it and make your life better. So I really want you to enjoy this. It's, you know, there's not a lot of times where I am completely just blown away by certain things somebody says, but this podcast, this episode, I was just like, wait, what did you just say? And it's awesome. So enjoy it. And I'll catch you on the backside. Really cool to have you here. I wanted to poke at all these things that you offer and you talk about. One of the things, I have an estrogen dominance support group on Facebook, and it's got almost 20,000 members, mostly women. And it's something that I have been challenged with for 7 years, having this podcast and that group. Something that comes up, and it's changed, you know, like my demographic has changed. It used to just be perimenopausal women, menopausal women. Now it's, you know, 20-year-olds getting hysterectomies, and it's just vastly different now. But one thing that has stayed consistent from the beginning is diet discussion and working out. The big fad of ketogenic diet and paleo and the big fad of intermittent fasting happened. And it was cool for a while. And now we still have a lot of people who are just love it, right? They do really well with it. But then I'm starting to see the repercussions of people who have been on it for a while. And it's all showing up as adrenal exhaustion and thyroid stuff. So talk to me first about what the hell is going on with that.
Yeah. So as you said, those modalities for whether it's more health-based or weight loss-based are still very popular. And I fell into them myself when I was kind of earlier on in my health journey and, you know, was doing it full on the ketogenic diets and then maybe cyclical ketogenic diets later on and intermittent fasting and the higher intensity exercise and everything. And I, you know, began to notice that it wasn't working as well for me as I had hoped. And as someone who, you know, really tries, you know, is very committed to health things, and then started seeing the same in a lot of other people who I was suggesting it to. And I know you're talking mostly about women, and normally that's what, like, it'll show up much sooner in women than men because of the kind of hormonal sensitivity. But in, you know, just kind of the briefest way to put it is that those are modalities that work through driving stress, which can be really great in the short term as far as losing weight goes. They do have some separate benefits that come from their effects on the gut that are more legitimate benefits. But over time, the stress catches up with us and starts to override the benefits that we may have been getting initially, both from the gut effects. And there's also sometimes a benefit to shifting into more of a fat burning state when someone is struggling to properly burn carbohydrates. And it's not the best solution, but it's still better than inefficiently using carbohydrates. For example, if we have someone who's diabetic, is, you know, more of the extreme end, giving them a lot of carbohydrates tends not to work too well if you don't sort out what the problem is in the first place. So putting them on a low carb diet, you'll see a lot of benefits initially.
So let's talk about kind of the origins. I know a little bit, well, a lot about the ketogenic diet because my husband and I, he's a chiropractor, and we work with children that have disabilities, that have vaccine injuries, that have cerebral palsy, and a lot of seizures. And so the ketogenic diet was often used in with these families because it would control their seizures. So I know this is completely like kind of going off the rails for a second, but I just don't want to lose the thought. So if it's driving the stress, but it's helping them control the seizures, I mean, how do you feel about that? Do you feel like there's probably a deeper level of being able to help these children that goes beyond just the ketogenic diet? Or do you think in some cases it's just absolutely necessary because of that reason?
So it's actually a perfect question because there's some research explaining exactly what is going on here. And they have looked at rodent models where they're dealing with these epileptic seizures, and they put them on a ketogenic diet and they have benefits. And then what they have done after that is they take the microbiota from, you know, the gut microbiome from those rodents who had all these benefits, transplant it to rodents who were not on a ketogenic diet, but were still dealing with the same seizures, and they had the same benefits. So another way of putting that is that the interface that we're seeing the benefits for ketogenic diets on these sorts of seizures is through the gut, through the effects on the gut. And yeah, I think that that is really indicative of where the benefits are coming from. And the good news, I would say, is that you can get those same benefits for the gut without a ketogenic diet, without the stress. And that's the route that I would prefer to go.
Interesting. So that's probably a matter of, well, then we get down to something you really talk about a lot in your podcast, which is about generating energy. Like that's our whole thing, right? Is like acquiring fuel, converting it to energy, clearing out the exhaust and the waste from that, and that whole process and how it needs to be like a metabolically a well-oiled machine. I mean, not to focus on these children, but it was probably very similar in us. Like, so switching that microbiome, and that goes back to working on my favorite thing, which is gut balance, gut health. And so what would that look like in terms of like, is that just diet changes? Is that probiotics? Is that all of it?
As you talk about it a lot, you know, the gut is such a central point and, you know, a focal point in any disease process and any sort of degenerative state, and tends to be a major contributor. And so that's why I think there are such benefits when people are removing something like carbohydrates, or they're just fasting altogether. They're removing the triggers of that state, but they're not actually solving the problem when you know, we're just avoiding the problem. We're not actually solving it. Mm-hmm. And solving it can be a lot trickier, for sure. There's a lot that goes into it, whether it's considering just the digestive aspects of how well are we breaking down the protein, the carbohydrates, the fats that we're taking in, how well is the partially digested or fully digested food moving through our intestines? Is it too slow where it's allowing bacteria to grow higher and higher and leading to a state of SIBO, like a small intestinal bacterial overgrowth? Are we creating a dysbiotic large intestine and microbial imbalance there due to the types of foods that we're eating? So it's a complex problem for sure. Mm-hmm. And one that I think has to be kind of tackled at all angles. But I would say that in general, if we're eating easily digested foods that are not feeding the wrong microbes, we're including the types of compounds that help to properly shape our microbiome. And that would be mostly polyphenols and bioflavonoids and certain types of fibers. And then if we're doing the things to support us metabolically, we should be checking the most important boxes to restore and improve gut health. And sometimes we might need some more detailed, like more specific approaches on top of that. But I would say that's kind of the underlying foundation. And of course, the metabolism piece being a major part as well, where we know that hypothyroidism, which is just basically a low metabolism, is really tightly associated with small intestinal bacterial overgrowths, with reduced bile concentration or bile output, which bile is one of the main antimicrobials that keeps our small intestine clear. The thyroid also is directly related to the migrating motor complex, which is the movement of the intestines, the activity of the muscles of the intestines, the peristalsis that moves through food through properly so that it doesn't feed the bacteria excessively. And yeah, I mean, there's a few other kind of areas where thyroid's involved, but essentially getting our metabolism in check is going to be also paramount for resolving those gut issues.
So, you know, I like to keep things like for my audience, like super simple and just take like clinical and scientific information and try to make it like really easily digestible. So it can get overwhelming. So let's see if I can think of other ways to like, okay, for me, you know, I've always been thin and finding out that I probably have been hypothyroid my whole life and adrenaline dominant and, you know, working on that now at 52, which is nuts. But now that I've, you know, when I reached perimenopause, I started to get this like gut in the front, just that adipose apron, they call it, right? Just that right in front of the belly there. And, you know, and it's just frustrating. And also it's not healthy. It's just not healthy to have that. And I know as a health practitioner what that can mean. And it can mean, you know, pre-diabetic, and it can mean high estrogen and high cortisol and all sorts of things like that. So I was like, you know what? I'm not a big coffee drinker, but I'm like, I'm gonna try the like bulletproof thing because I heard that if you have it with some fat, that it might reduce jitters and that it is food and that I can go to the gym. So I would wake up in the morning and then I would go to the, I would have like, just like 4 ounces of coffee, but I would have like 4 ounces of cream and maybe a little butter, like super fatty. And then I would go to I'd walk a mile to the gym, work out for 27 minutes exactly in this kind of high intensity, but you know, I know how to keep it low. I know how to, if I'm not breathing through my mouth, I mean, through my nose, I know that I've gotten too extreme. And so I just back off. I don't use props and all the things that everyone else is doing in this class. So I manage it. I'm like, I got this down. 2 weeks later, I've lost like 8 pounds right from my belly and I'm looking good. I'm feeling energized, really energized, like maybe too energized. And I started to think, and then I met Constantine and I started taking my temp and my pulse. And at first it was fine. It was like all in range. And then I started to do all these other things. I stopped doing the bulletproof and everything fell out of range. I'm still out of range, right? My pulse is under, my heart rate is under, I mean, my temperature is under, and I'm gaining the fat back. So I know you can't diagnose and figure out my whole situation, but a lot of women go through this where they're like, I love the fasting. I feel energized and I'm losing weight. And now you're telling me that it's not a good thing. So why can't I use that fat in the morning? First of all, that's my first question for you.
There's nothing wrong with taking in fat in the morning, but the biggest factor that influences our state of stress first comes down to energy, but the layer on top of that is, do we have enough proper fuel to have enough energy to get us out of a stress state? And when we sleep, you know, for ideally, let's say 8 hours overnight, or maybe a little more, we are running on our stored fuel. And so when we wake up, those fuel stores are pretty low. And that's a normal mechanism that's actually supposed to increase stress hormones. We have a peak of stress hormones in the morning. And that's supposed to naturally wake us up if we weren't relying on alarm clocks. Mm-hmm. And that's really great. But of course, we want those stress hormones to come down. We know that long term, when we're looking at, let's just say, cortisol, it's not ideal for weight, you know, our weight balance or weight gain. It's also not ideal for our immune function, for our digestive function, our thyroid function, reproductive function, and on from there. So if we don't take in some carbohydrates in the morning, pretty soon after we wake up, those stress hormones will stay elevated. And if we not only don't have carbohydrates, but we add coffee on top of that, that's going to kind of press the gas pedal down a little bit further when we're already on an empty fuel tank. And that's going to run those stress hormones even higher. So as you were saying, you'll definitely feel pretty energized doing that. And that's that kind of adrenaline talking. And it feels good for a while and it works well for a while until it doesn't. And that's because we're leaning into these stress-based mechanisms for energy, as opposed to producing energy in a healthier way that also supports our hormonal health, again, as opposed to the opposite.
So that would look like crashes in the middle of the day, like a healthy, balanced thyroid and energetic energy production, healthy metabolism is going to look like that that pattern in our cortisol, that cortisol pattern that many of us are familiar with, where it spikes in the morning and then it drops and it elevates a little bit and it goes back down. That all of that stuff is like a ideal healthy thyroid energy production. So when we have these like, oh, I feel so good, I'm at the gym, I'm fantastic, and I come home and I weigh myself and it's all good, and I call it chihuahua mode, which is basically me. And then all of a sudden, and then like 3 o'clock rolls around and I can't keep my eyes open. And I'm like, boom, just full blown crash. I'm like, oh, I better have some food. That's another thing. I don't have much of an appetite through the day if I have all that adrenaline, and that's not a good thing. And so then, so that would look like energy crashes, right? Like how can someone, before they reach like what Georgi Dinkov talks about when he reached that point where he was so sick that he had to go to the hospital and get all these tests done. Before we reach that point, what are the different signs besides crashes that we're probably not metabolizing things well and doing it right?
Yeah, there definitely are early signs. So those energy fluctuations for sure. Mm-hmm. A couple others would be insomnia or struggling to fall asleep or stay asleep. Those are really common. It's a really common one that I see when people are coming from low carb is, you know, it might take several months to show up, but they'll start to see that. Cold hands and feet or cold body temperature overall is another one that tends to come early on. From there, it does tend to compound maybe into more digestive sensitivity or food sensitivities overall. An increased reliance on things like caffeine to have that energy or other supplements, you know, a lot that are kind of disguised as just, you know, something that's kind of boosting or it's nootropic or something, when in reality, like our natural state should be one where we can focus well and think well and have energy without those sorts of things. So that would be kind of, a few parameters I'd be looking out for.
Yeah. And so this is also taken for these women in my group who are, you know, they have a baby, maybe they have two, maybe they have three, and then they're in their late 30s or coming up in their 40s, and they start to have an impossibility. It's like impossible for them to lose weight. And then they find HIIT training and they find, bulletproof coffee, and they are doing great. And then they reach this sort of cap, this plateau where they actually aren't losing weight anymore. They're actually gaining weight. Now, is that a cortisol response? What is that? A lot of women will say, I do everything right, and I used to be an athlete, or I was a cheerleader my whole life, or whatever. And now they do things that they're like, I barely eat, I have a clean diet, and now I'm just not losing the weight. And when I work out, I feel like I'm gaining it.
Yeah. And you see that whether it's coming from a low calorie, like just low calorie, or also fasting or low carb, they'll all kind of converge, or just excessive exercise. All of those have the same effect, right? They're all situations where we're creating excessive energy demands relative to our energy supply. So whether it's the amount of food that's coming in or how well we're using it, it's much less than what we're putting on our bodies. And again, it works really well short-term. It's a really quick, easy way to lose weight, but it's essentially like taking out a loan, right, to pay for that difference in energy. And we end up having to pay it back at some point. So an analogy I like to use here is that, again, we're taking out a loan. It's energy debt because we're in an energy deficit state, and our bodies recognize that they can't keep taking out that loan. And so they start to conserve their currency, their energy, right? So they start using less energy on digestion, less energy on our libido or reproductive function, less energy on our cognitive function, less energy on our repair, less energy on our hair and skin and nails, things like that, that are all kind of getting conserved so that they can survive. Mm-hmm. And again, short-term, we might not notice these things. They tend to build up long-term. And another way of saying that is basically that our metabolism comes down, right? So our bodies are trying to conserve energy as much as possible. They're trying not to expend energy. And that's when you start to see that before maybe you were losing weight when you were down to 1500 calories, and maybe you maintained your weight at 1800, and then you dieted for a while, and now you're barely maintaining your weight at 1500, you know, like that number tends to go down farther and farther. And you see this pattern where you have to diet harder and harder every time. You get fewer and fewer, less and less result. And then you're stuck.
That is such a good analogy. It's like taking out a loan and thinking that you're rich, right? You're like,
right.
I took out $100,000 loan. I got money. You're like, it's not how it works. Okay. That makes perfect sense. All right. So then, how long does it take? So, you know, I've incorporated, which is a new thing for me, to telling all of my clients and all my, my people in my group and everything that, I mean, I used to always think that thyroid, if you had a thyroid issue, you had a gut issue. And though that is entirely true, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't address the thyroid, which is what I was doing. I was saying, well, let's just fix the gut and we'll fix the thyroid. But that clearly has not been working for me. And so now I'm telling people, you know, check your waking pulse and temp. And then 40 minutes after you have lunch, check it again and do that for a week, 2 weeks and see how in range or out of range that you are. So, well, first of all, what's up with out with too high? Is that hyperthyroid if it's too high all the time?
Hyperthyroidism is generally very rare, even in the cases where it's diagnosed as such. I still think it's very rare and often misdiagnosed. And it's really unfortunate because some people start to either get their thyroid removed or they use like radioactive iodine treatment to damage it. So it's not producing as much thyroid hormone, which is, it's a path that I would ideally try not to go down if possible. But the problem, so temperature and pulse can be really great indicators of our metabolic health, but like a lot of markers, they're influenced by different factors. So of course, they're going to be influenced by the temperature outside or the temperature inside, things like that, but they'll also be influenced by stress hormones. So if our stress hormones are very high, that can lead to an elevated temperature. And normally, a good way to determine whether your temperature or pulse are increased by stress hormones is by eating something that has some carbohydrates that should decrease stress. And if your temperature was high or higher prior to eating, you eat some carbohydrates or a full meal, and then afterward it comes down, then that's normally a sign that the previous elevation was due to stress hormones because we brought those stress hormones down by eating a good meal and our temperature came down. So that's normally kind of the best indication that a high temperature isn't actually a good thing in that instance.
Interesting. Because when I started doing it, I was in range the whole time. I don't know did I say that already? I was in range every day for a week. And we were like, wow, I'm impressed. It's like, no, you're running on adrenaline and you always have been. So once I started to take the desiccated thyroid and I started to take, you know, do everything else. And now it's under range. So how long does that process take? Like, if you're going to, with me, for example, like what it's going to be different for everyone, but how long is it going to take to reverse that from operating on adrenaline and having that under range? I mean, for average, how long would it take to get that sorted?
Yeah. So of course there's a lot of variability, right? And it depends, I think, largely on how far we dug ourselves in the other direction, right? How much were we running on that stress? Was it a few months? Was it years? Was it decades? And how much were we dieting? How much were we removing carbs? And where are we at now? And so I think those are all going to be the most important, like those are going to be the things that dictate how long it'll take to recover, more or less. And it doesn't mean that if you were hardcore yo-yo dieting for 20 years, that it'll take 20 years to recover. But we do want to keep in mind that this process of getting into a hypothyroid state isn't like an unintelligent response. It's a very intelligent response by our bodies where they've adapted to whatever environment we've put them in for an extended period of time where they were saying, we're not getting the energy we need. So we need to go into that conservation state. And that's what allows us to survive if we're in a famine or if we're dieting or if we have to, you know, undergo a lot of exercise or we don't sleep very well for a long time. You know, these are stressful situations and our body tends toward that kind of conservation mode. It's a really great system. It's helped us a lot. But so with that, we don't necessarily want it to just switch automatically right away. We need to tell it that it's in a good enough environment that it actually can lean away from that conservation and start producing and using more energy again. So of course, like I wish I could give a real concrete answer as far as timeline. I will say that we should start to see benefits and differences relatively soon, right? Mm-hmm. Within weeks to months.
Yeah.
And we should continue to see those benefits continue over months, right? Mm-hmm. When it comes to the weight loss side, that I think tends to be one of the last things we see. And so that could be a little longer.
You know? Of course. that makes sense too, because I definitely am sleeping better. So that's something that, you know, I really wasn't sleeping through the night when I started going through perimenopause. So that is changing. So this brings me into this whole other aspect of things that you talk about often that are very challenging for a lot of people to hear. So you said it really depends how quickly you'll recover your thyroid balance or your metabolic balance, depending on your history and everything. But I'm imagining that a lot of that has to do with what you're doing to support that, like dietary stuff, you know, bring, and maybe we can talk about what type of exercise would be good for some people, like the women in my group, for example, or for everybody. But first, so going into that diet, the diet choices. Now, a lot of people are really shocked in my group to hear, and I've been talking about refined oils for a long time. I never said PUFAs. I've just been saying, you know, get rid of refined oils at the very least. And, you know, it goes over okay. People are just like, okay, well, I'll just use olive oil. But tell us about how damaging polyunsaturated fats can be for this metabolic issue that we're talking about.
Yeah, so I think it's always helpful when we keep that, you know, kind of zoom out first. And when we look at what polyunsaturated fats do in nature, mm-hmm. is they drive hibernation and lower body temperatures and lower metabolism. They do it in fish. They allow them to keep a low body temperature. They allow them to function with a low body temperature when they're swimming in cold waters. They allow for animals that hibernate to hibernate, like bears, for example. They need to have the polyunsaturated fats there in order to hibernate. And they also do the same thing in seeds. They allow seeds to remain essentially alive, you know, without dying during winters and very early spring when it's very cold. And they do the same thing for us. And there's three main mechanisms through which they do this. But essentially what they do is they slow down our metabolism. They create or reduce the efficiency that with which we produce energy. And that helps to shift us into a hibernation state where we're storing fat, where our energy is low, our cognitive function comes down, our digestion is decreased. And because of that, and because of how ubiquitous they are in our food supply, I think they're one of the main drivers of the issues that people are experiencing currently.
So I just thought of Eskimos.
They are getting a pretty decent amount of polyunsaturated fats from the cold water animals that they're eating, which are very high in omega-3s. And I think that that is partially necessary for them to live in a state where they're in a very, very cold environment. And some of the things that the polyunsaturated fats do is they, at least in part, and then try to like kind of keep it simple, there can be like dichotomous effects. Like it can have different effects in different contexts, but when it drives a less efficient state of energy production, what it's doing is instead of converting the fuel that we're taking in to actual usable energy, it'll end up diverting a lot to heat. And so, you know, and then diverting the rest toward essentially fat storage. So there can be some benefits there in terms of dealing with a harsh environment, but it's still coming at the cost of metabolic health. And I would say the environment that the Inuit are in is not conducive toward like optimal metabolic health, honestly.
Right, because their physical structures too, like a lot of belly fat, a lot of heavy set fat. That makes sense. Okay, you did make sense of what I was trying to say or think of. Yeah.
And also the they're kind of pointed to for a long time as like a poster child of low carb diets because they're supposed to not have any heart disease or anything despite eating very high fat. But the more recent research was actually finding that didn't seem to be all that accurate, that they do still deal with heart disease, at least at the same rate that it's occurring in other places. And this idea that they were like a great model of health seemed to kind of not be as accurate as was once thought.
Interesting. That's bad news for a lot of people because polyunsaturated fats are in almost everything. They're in everything from mayonnaise, I mean, to, you know, like salad dressings. I mean, everybody cooks with them. I saw a study done once on heart disease, and they took omnivores, vegans, vegetarians. It was just this huge study of people, and found that the heart, the amount of people who had heart disease was kind of across the board. It was not, it didn't favor the carnivores. It definitely. And so my mentor said, you know, the common denominator here was not that they're eating refined oil. They're eating polyunsaturated fats. And that's what the common denominator is. So that's true, isn't it? I mean, it's probably one of the big contributors to heart disease and strokes.
Yeah, all of the advice to run away from the saturated fats and consume the polyunsaturated fats for heart disease has really not been based in sound research and physiology. And yeah, I think has directed a lot of people down the wrong path. And what they actually find instead is that, so polyunsaturated fats, one of their major problems is that they're very weak, they're very unstable. And this is part of why if you have like a fish oil supplement or maybe flaxseed or something, it needs to be in a really dark glass container. You have to keep it, you know, away in the cupboard or in like a low temperature environment because it's very susceptible to getting damaged. And the same thing happens internally. I mean, our bodies are operating ideally at 98 degrees or a little bit above that Fahrenheit. Mm-hmm. And that allows for these fats to get damaged. And you see the damaged fats, these damaged unsaturated fats, in virtually every disease process, very clear correlation. Part of that's because of the fats. Part of that's also the environment of excessive oxidative stress. But you also see that specifically in heart disease. So in the vasculature, you know, they talk about plaques. Well, a large portion of plaque is made up of oxidized unsaturated fat. And which I think just kind of very clearly, you know, it's at least partially mechanistic as far as what's going on there. But there's a lot more implicating the polyunsaturated fats in causing heart disease.
So they're almost impossible to avoid. I mean, it really, like, it's one thing to go out and buy a bottle of flax oil, hemp oil, whatever, even olive oil. It's one thing to do that. But then, like, in our foods, like nuts and seeds, you know, I recommend in my hormone group often for women who have very low levels of all hormones across the board, I recommend before we start getting them on bioidenticals is to seed cycle, you know, seed cycling, right? So mm-hmm. It's like the pumpkin, the sesame, the flax, and the sunflower seeds throughout the month. And, you know, two of them encourage luteal phase, two of them encourage the follicular phase and support that. But these seeds, I mean, if you're doing a teaspoon of these seeds every day in a shake, that's a problem. That question?
I would say that I don't think it's ideal from a digestive metabolic health standpoint. Yeah. Sorry to burst the bubble. I mean, and I maybe there are other hormonal effects that can outweigh that to an extent. I would also maybe, like, personally, I would try to look toward other methods for having that same effect that don't involve higher PUFA foods.
Right. Hey everyone, thanks for listening to this episode of Stuff Your Doctor Should Know. I wanted to briefly interrupt and remind you about Just Thrive spore-based probiotics, and I wanted you to listen to a quick clip of Kiran Krishnan, the celebrity microbiologist, talking about how important a diverse microbiome is and spore-based probiotics.
And the biggest issue with the allergies and all the crazy sensitivities, when you look at the prevalence rate of peanut allergies and environmental allergens, and the fact that asthma is now among kids is a pandemic, you know, all of these things are because of the loss of oral tolerance. The loss of oral tolerance means that what we used to be able to do is take in huge amounts of different, you know, proteins and antigens and things that people would now be allergic to. The immune system would be able to sample it. The bacteria within your gut would be there to help the immune system figure out, this is something you need to attack and this is something you need to leave alone. That's the process of immune tutoring. And that is lost when we lose the diversity in our microbiome.
Thanks for listening to Kiran Krishnan. If you want to use your coupon code HGG20 to get 20% off, just go to justthrivehealth.com and check out all the great things they have. And now back to the show. I guess, you know, I mean, I've always been, since I've been doing this for 12, 13 years now, is just you know, I don't want to stand on a soapbox on of the knowledge I have and be like, this is the way. You know, it's not a religion, right? It's science, and we have to grow and move with what data we see that rings true. So, you know, it does burst my bubble, but it also is like, wow, that's crazy, because I've always just felt like being an omnivore is really a good thing. Like, just, you know, having a diverse diet and rotating out what you eat and eating seasonally and having green leafy veggies, but then switching out and having, I feel like it has contributed to my health. I feel like the big problems that I have in my life have to do with my stress and adrenaline up here. But now I'm starting to learn from you and all these other people who I'm being introduced to that those diet choices of mine might be driving and even contributing to my stress state. Right?
Yeah, potentially. And I don't know exactly what's falling under that omnivore umbrella, but yeah, I think, as you said, it's really hard to avoid the PUFA modern day. And I don't necessarily think that is representative at all of what we might've been eating at any time historically. And I think there's a lot of options that are relatively low in PUFA, and there's a lot of things that we can do to make less digestible foods more digestible. So if we're talking leafy greens and we cook them a decent amount, we'll get rid of a lot of those anti-nutrients. And I think that's, you know, generally okay. I wouldn't make them the centerpiece of the diet, but, you know, it's more of a supplementary piece. I don't see anything wrong with that. In the same way that there's a lot of extensive processing that goes into getting a seed oil, there's a lot that goes into, you know, getting walnuts or almonds from a tree or something. And I think ideally we would have not been leaning toward those food sources as much, but yeah, it gets there's a lot that we can discuss in terms of like maybe a more like what was going on historically and evolutionarily, but it's, I don't know. It's a bit of a side. Yeah.
Another podcast for another episode for another day. Yeah. But no, that makes sense too, because, you know, I feel when I say omnivore, I'm really specific about with my clients and when I'm trying to help educate people about diet is like, you know, yeah, I think about what we were doing before the Industrial Revolution, and were we able to eat a teaspoon of seeds a day? Did we have a teaspoon of those seeds a day? Access to that? Did we have kiwis in the middle of December? Did we have access to? So I always feel like rotating everything, you know, I would never do the same thing I wouldn't have kale smoothies every day of my life, you know? But I do feel like having kale when it's in season, and then after having it a couple of times, switching out to bok choy, and just like, that's how I've always been. But now I'm starting to get, I guess, more into biohacking glasses with this stuff. And it's hard because people fight it. And I'm pretty open to all this stuff, you know, but like in the group, you talk about diet in my group and you're going to get some fireworks. It's wild. People really attach themselves to, and people think if this is working, then that's it. That's the science, right? But like with the fasting, yeah, you're losing weight, but at what cost? And that's a hard pill to swallow for people, you know, which is also brings me to the next very jagged little pill, the sugar. So, you know, coming out of the sugar is in everything to sugar is cancer. And now sugar, I remember Sean who joined our group and now he's also a moderator. One day these women were saying, I just can't see, I fall asleep and then I wake up at like 2 a.m. every night or 3 a.m. What is going on? What is that? And I'm like, oh, you know, maybe have some sweet potatoes before bed. Maybe I'm talking about a little carbohydrate. He's like, screw the sweet potatoes. Have a couple of tablespoons of high quality vanilla ice cream. And I just like laughed, you know. And guess what I'm doing now? I buy this really good, organic, high quality, plain vanilla ice cream. And I have a couple tablespoons sometimes with my Thyromax or whatever it is. And before bed and I'll sleep through the night. So talk about sugar, please, and insulin resistance.
Yeah. So, and again, I've been there. I've been in the camp where I was eating as low sugar as possible. Even when I came across the bioenergetic view and started dipping my toes in, I was measuring how much fructose I was getting in, trying to, you know, I was initially doing higher carbohydrate with very low fructose, still a lot of fear there. You know, and even before that, it started with just some berries, you know, then it was more starches. But so I've been there and I totally understand the concern. And I kind of parroted a lot of it myself as well, you know, talking about how sugar drives insulin resistance. And of course, that is underlying all of these metabolic diseases. And I also, after kind of digging through it more, realized that I didn't really understand the mechanisms there. And I think, you know, probably that's part of where a lot of the frustration comes from when you're hearing an opposing view and you don't fully understand, you know, necessarily why it's not true. I think that can be even a little bit more triggering sometimes. But I think this sleep is a great example. And in general, what we're looking at is carbohydrates as the primary energy source for our brain, our nervous system, our livers, and, you know, a few other tissues in the body that really favor carbohydrates. And when they're so important, so ubiquitously important, that if we don't have them, our bodies will go to really great lengths to produce them themselves. So if you're not eating any carbohydrate, we will create the release of stress hormones, glucagon, adrenaline, cortisol, and we'll convert the protein either from the protein we're taking in, or we'll start, you know, if we have enough cortisol, we'll start breaking down our own tissues and we'll convert that to carbohydrates. It's not an efficient process. It comes at the cost of our own protein structure. And yet we'll do that because it's that, you know, that important to have some amount of carbohydrates coming in. And I think that kind of goes to show how important they are. And the fact that we can so easily dip into stress just by not having carbohydrates for, you know, several hours is also indicative of that. You know, it's very easy to trigger a cortisol response just by not eating for long enough. And a lot of times people will know this. So something I wanted to mention earlier when we were talking about symptoms, but hot flashes, which are so often associated just with the hormones, are often really directly tied with blood sugar and stress hormones, cortisol. And I can't tell you how many women I've worked with where they were dealing with hot flashes all throughout the day and sometimes all throughout the night as well, and saw dramatic improvements just by increasing, again, from the right sources, but increasing carbohydrates considerably, spacing them out well, having well-balanced meals, and having that balanced blood sugar so they weren't seeing that drop in blood sugar and the rise in cortisol, which drives that hot flash.
Wow.
And yeah, and again, like, so, you know, these are people who have tried a lot of things, just focused on either reducing estrogen or supporting progesterone, really focused on those reproductive hormones, but not realizing that the underlying driver of stress is not having enough energy, which comes in part from not having enough carbohydrates.
I mean, okay, so right forms of carbohydrates then. what would you say those are?
Yeah, I would say the ideal form is, or the ideal forms would be fruit, like ripe, high quality fruit. A lot of vitamins and minerals, a lot of polyphenols that help to shape our microbiome, some beneficial fibers along with those, but other forms of fruit, you know, whether it's dried fruit or fruit juice are good as well. Mm-hmm. And roots and tubers. So sweet potatoes of different varieties, regular potatoes, squashes, which are actually more like fruits. But those would all be the sources I would favor when it comes to carbs.
So I can hear the women in my mind right now in my group, just like, I can't have fruit because of candida. You know, I can't have high carbohydrate or things that easily turn to sugar because it flares up my candida.
Yeah. So candida, the number one thing that allows for fungus to grow, especially in our bodies, is a low body temperature. So
what?
And there's some really great research looking at that. But yeah, so low metabolism is really putting us in a compromised state that allows for something like candida to grow in the first place, which is of course a huge factor. But the other thing is candida is most likely to spread when it's starved. That's its way of trying to find more food, is it'll start to spread. So, and that's something that's really common. People have candida, is maybe it starts in the gut, but then it ends up, you know, they're having it in different areas of their skin, maybe on their feet, their nails, or even vaginally, like with yeast infections, becomes a systemic issue. And that's actually what happens when it's not fed glucose. And I know it's very counterintuitive. And I've been there as well, like dealt with issues that were related to candida. And there's, at the same time, there's something to be said for sure for aggravating this with certain types of foods, certain types of carbohydrates. And there's something there, but it's not as simple as just wanting to avoid all of them.
Yeah. I mean, that's that's mind bomb right there, because, you know, all of these women, I've never heard that. And all of these women in the group, you can tell we're all dealing with some level of hypothyroid, and, you know, some more severe than others, but the candida, it's just this crazy, vicious little cycle of, you know, so if it's lower body temp, the candida is growing and thriving. And then, you know, you're fasting, so you're starving it, you're losing weight, you're feeling good, you're high on adrenaline, you're feeling like everything is going well. But then your hormones start to really pay the price, and you start to, progesterone becomes a problem, because it's being shunted to make the cortisol that's up there with the adrenaline. And it's, and now your estrogen is dominating, even if it's low. And now the candida is worse because they're best friends. And now histamine goes and runs amok. I mean, you know what you did? You shed some light on some of the puzzling facts about candida. And yeah, so avoiding, like, I used to have candida so bad that if I just had an orange, I would get a chest infection. It would just flare up the candida in my lungs, and I would not be able to, I just start coughing and for, you know, a week, you know. And that's like, am I allergic to oranges? No, I can eat tons of oranges now. It's just, so avoiding the fruit, yeah, because maybe it's causing some problems in the moment, but what's the root cause? And if we just go back, it sounds like what you're saying, and what you say in your podcast a lot, is just going back to, how are you efficiently burning this fuel? How are you, what fuel are you burning? How are you burning it? And then how are you getting rid of all the waste and the exhaust, which of course involves your gut health in there as well. Well, in both processes, right? In digestion. That is just so good. That is really very enlightening. I appreciate that.
Yeah, no, you're welcome. I'm glad it was helpful. And I will say, in that case, somebody might need to favor the really easily digestible carbs, mm-hmm. the maybe leaning more into certain fruit juices over whole fruits that are more fibrous, maybe some maple syrup or honey, you know, definitely starting slowly kind of leaning out of that stress state and bringing metabolism up, because we also don't want to be dramatically aggravating an intestinal infection at the same time. So mm-hmm. it has to be a little bit of a balance. If it's severe enough, maybe using some specific, you know, antifungals. But again, I'm sure you've seen this a lot, that just using antifungals for a fungal infection is often not enough. It often doesn't right. work if we're not addressing the underlying drivers of that state. And largely that comes back to metabolism.
Yeah. So you can just be drinking all the monolaurin in the world, and it's not going to help your ultimately. I mean, this is something that I have always believed, and my mentor instilled in me, is, you know, okay, you have a parasite. Okay, you have heavy metals. Okay, you have Lyme disease. But let's talk about why you are suffering with it. A lot of people get bit by ticks. A lot of people get Lyme. A lot of people get parasites. A lot of people get exposed to, everybody does get exposed to heavy metals. Why did I fall victim to having these problems? Why did my parasite, when I got sick in Mexico or whatever, why did it turn into, you know, a viral paresis, gastric viral paresis? What happened? And that, in therein lies, I feel like, the issue. Like, is it because most likely you're hypothyroid and you're not able to fight and eliminate these pathogens and these foes because you're just not operating at optimum, you know, on all cylinders. Like you just said, you know, you can take all the antifungals you want, but where's that fungus going to go? It's not going to go anywhere. You might quiet it down for a moment, but you're probably going to piss it off, and it's probably going to grow because you've never addressed the fact that you don't eat right. You don't eat often enough. You're stressed out all the time. You're in fight or flight, you know. And that's tough because parent families, you know, women and the women in this group, I don't have kids. I have a luxury of like self-care every day. You know, they don't have that luxury. They've got children. They've got a job. They've got, maybe they're single parents. Like, it just becomes really a lot to manage these things.
No, I mean, I wholeheartedly agree with what you were saying earlier, that we don't want to just blame some external factor for why we're responding in the way that we are. And also wholeheartedly agree that it's difficult to sort out what the right thing is to do. And it's also difficult to do it, especially in just every, you know, everything feels stacked against us in this modern world. So I totally feel for the people listening who are in those positions that you were describing.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a new client and a friend who came to me. You know, he's a fireman. He's, really active his whole life. And, but he suffered from gut stuff his whole life. And then it just got really bad and he couldn't, you know, now he's 230 pounds. He's, you know, he can't eat anything without severe bloat and massive constipation. And it's just to the point now where he just, you know, he just wanted to die. And so I was thinking, you know, what if we got him some really easy to digest food, pre-digested foods like kefir, like raw kefir. And, you know, right away he noticed a difference, you know, and then his thyroid's very low. And now we're in this position now where it's hard to move forward because he's gaining weight again. He's already gaining weight because of the fact that he is eating, but his thyroid's still low. He's in a position that he feels paralyzed, even though he sees some progress and he's very happy. I mean, when someone, and I've worked with a lot of people like this, where they're just, their guts have shut down. They're just in a state of paralysis and their thyroid is probably just like barely kicking. You know, what would you do? Where would you start with that person? You, like, where would you start with that person?
So normally I would start kind of as you described, right? Nourishing somebody with easily digestible foods, making sure they're balancing blood sugar by eating semi-regularly throughout the day, getting balanced meals that typically will have not just carbs alone, but a combination of fat and protein when someone's struggling with blood sugar regulation. And again, making sure that we're not feeding overgrown bacteria and things like that, which are super common in the intestine. And that's normally the place that I start. Mm-hmm. But there are certainly times where there are like something like an intense SIBO can be a limiting factor. It can be inhibiting our progress in other areas. And so sometimes there's a bit of a balancing act of trying to address one, you know, the first side as much as possible, and then kind of hitting a bit of maybe a plateau or a sticking point where then we realize, okay, we do need to work on some sort of, you know, means of getting rid of the SIBO while we also work to support your metabolism. And so there's a bit of that balancing act there for sure, depending on the situation. It's not, you know, it's not always the gut that's the limiting factor, but gut issues are definitely a very common one. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to the weight gain side, again, we're kind of weighing each side here, you know, the benefits to sleep and digestion and mood and energy and hormones versus maybe some small amount of potential weight gain. Although I will say anything, like if we're seeing considerable amounts of weight gain, maybe more than, I would say 10 to 15 pounds, and it's kind of continuing to climb, I think that's normally a sign that there are some maybe missteps or mistakes, or we're kind of doing too much too soon when it comes to calories or carbohydrates. Mm-hmm. And again, that's not always an overall bad thing. It might speed up the progress, but there might be some extra weight gain in the meantime. But I tend to prefer a slightly slower, a little bit more measured approach, because if someone's coming from low carb or low calorie, and you immediately jump up the amount of calories or carbs that they're eating, it can cause weight gain and fast without giving the body enough time to adjust and prepare and meet this like better, more supportive environment with a higher metabolism. Hmm. So I do, you know, I will sometimes pump the brakes a little bit when someone's really prone to weight gain.
Right. And that's interesting also, is like the idea that, you know, you could get a little worse in some ways before you get better, kind of like me with this thyroid thing right now. It's like I was in range and now I'm out of range, but things are starting to look better. You know, not in range yet, but I am sleeping through the night. So that's progress. So you want to be seeing some progress, I guess, is what you're saying. You don't want to just see this massive weight gain and nothing is really getting better, because then something's probably being overlooked.
Definitely. Yeah, okay. Definitely.
Cool. Well, you threw some mind bombs at me, which I love. And I had a feeling it would be that way just listening to your show. And all that stuff is going to be in the show notes. Do you have anything you want to throw at my women, at my audience before we go?
Yeah, definitely. So I know we talked a lot, you know, theoretical and why it's important to have carbohydrates, maybe why we don't want to be exercising too intensely, why we don't want to be fasting. But it can be tough to find a good place to start and maybe figure out some of the more basics of just, all right, like I'm on board or I'm open. How do we start to make those shifts? And so I have a free mini course, a free energy balance mini course that people can sign up for and learn some of those basics as far as nutrition and exercise and stress and things like that to start to improve their metabolism and resolve a lot of the symptoms that we were discussing, hot flashes and struggling to sleep throughout the night and mood and needing to rely on coffee and all of those things. And so, yeah, if anyone wants to sign up for that free mini course, they can head to jfeldmanwellness.com/energy.
Awesome. That's so great. And so if carbs help with stopping hot flashes, that let's be specific about what carbs. You mentioned the fruits. Like, we can't just be like, okay, I've got some chocolate covered pretzels here and I've got some, you know, whatever, maybe some little frozen pizzas in the refrigerator. Like, let's talk about your favorite carbs real quick.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. All carbs are not created equal, or fats or anything like that. But yeah, whole fruit, roots and tubers, I think are the best places to start. And maybe, you know, if someone's pretty, you know, metabolizing glucose well, having some of the more concentrated forms of dried fruit and fruit juice and honey, maple syrup, things like that can be mixed in as well. So those would be my favorite sources.
And what about sourdough bread? No?
It's definitely not something I would start with. I've seen too many times where people will have some sourdough and it just, I think sometimes it can drive a little bit of weight gain, a little bit of digestive issues. There's still some amount of gluten in there. And so some people are rather sensitive. And even without the gluten, it's still a grain and comes with some other issues that come with grains. So I think later on, it's something I'd maybe consider introducing once somebody's kind of over the hump, over the hill, everything's kind of trending in the right direction. Then I might do it for some variety, but it's not normally like in that initial phase, something I would add in.
Okay. And then last question, what are your favorite exercises for everybody?
Yeah. So my first recommendation when it comes to exercise is always, instead of focusing on just how much you can burn, try to find some sort of movement that you enjoy. And that can be walking or hiking or playing a sport or swimming or martial arts, or, you know, it could even be, you know, taking a run with friends or your dog or something. Mm-hmm. But I would try to shift toward enjoyable, maybe more sociable movement, as opposed to just trying to burn as much as possible and work as hard as you can and, you know, no pain, no gain sort of mentality. Mm-hmm. So that's always my first recommendation. And part of the reason for that is because I think the most important thing is that we're moving on a regular basis. Okay. I don't think it matters in most cases too much of what we're doing, as long as we're moving regularly. I do think there's instances or scenarios where it can help to have some more intense movement for sure. And then, you know, whether it's going to be weightlifting or sport or sprints or anything like that, mm-hmm. you know, or a class, those would all be fine. But I wouldn't, especially when someone's already like really focused on that intense movement, I would try to lean toward just general movement and exercise as opposed to forcing anything.
Nice. Well, that sounds good to me. Well, that's so great. I really appreciate your time. And that was just so educational, and I'm so thankful.
Thanks so much for having me on, Kitty.
How about that? How about that? How about Candida flourishes when you have a lower body temperature? Is that nuts? And listen, just because you might be having hot flashes doesn't mean you have a higher body temperature. Get this. I was checking my body temperature one morning and I just, right when I woke up, happened to be having a hot flash. Like, sometimes it still happens. I'm like, whoa, there goes a hot flash. And I'm like, should I get up and have a little glass of orange juice like Jay recommends? Or should I take my temperature? So I take my temperature and hot flash is still going on for a good, you know, 30 seconds or so. And guess what? My temperature was below the normal. It was like 97.6, I think. And that's, you would think that, you know, you feel like you're having a fever when you have a hot flash and you think there's no way that I am not having a hot temperature right now, but it's not the case, which is crazy. So just because you feel like you run hot, just because you're someone who maybe sweats a lot, because you feel like, you know, you're always sweating. A lot of guys have that issue, right? And that doesn't mean that you run hot, like your core body temperature. It doesn't mean you run hot. You could actually have hypothyroid and feel like, no, there's no way, because my pulse is always, you know, in range, and I always have, you know, I'm always warm. Nope. Surprise, surprise. So all of that information was really cool. I learned so much from him. And like I said, you should check out the Energy Balance podcast and his other show he mentioned with Danny Roddy, which I still haven't heard, but I'm looking forward to it. And then don't forget what I did to my shop page, friends. I totally revamped it so that things are listed like under digestion, detox, hormones, bone and mineral health. So you can go straight to the things that you are interested in instead of just randomly having them up there. And then they're not listed under brands. They're listed just individual products that are my favorite things. And so and underneath the product is, if I have a coupon to offer you, it's there underneath the photo of the product. So that's pretty cool. The only thing is that when you click on the link, it doesn't take you to the product. It just takes you to the website. So you have to then, like, if you click on like Monolaurin, it takes you to the Natural Cure website, and then you have to search for Monolaurin and then use the coupon code when you check out. So that's kind of a pain. I'd like to change that, but currently that's all I can do for you. So I hope you enjoy that. And if you want to reach out to Jay Feldman, please check him out in the show notes. As he mentioned, he has this Energy Balance course. It's this 8-week course that I think is pretty awesome. Teaches you how to heal your gut, regulate your blood sugar, reduce stress, and maximize your cellular energy. And that link is in the show notes. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time.